Support for Switched On Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Welcome to Switched On Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
I don't know about you, Nate, but I feel like we've had a relentless beat of major releases and tributes so far in just the beginning of this year. And I am finding it hard to keep up.
It is an embarrassment of riches, truly.
I feel like I do best if I take time to let things sink in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. You're like a sponge, a sexy sponge.
Thanks. So for the past 2 weeks, I've been really thoroughly absorbing Beyoncé's Lemonade, which we'll talk about in the first half of the show.
And I have been steeping myself in Prince's seemingly infinite back catalog, which we will be listening to in the second half of the episode with the help of someone who literally wrote their dissertation on funk, scholar and writer Matthew Volness.
Beautiful. All right, well, let's just kick things off. I am so excited to get into Beyoncé's new album, Lemonade.
Yes.
It's one of those albums where I just wish that we lived in the same city, because I would want to sit down and listen to this thing track by track and dissect every piece of it with you.
A classic Nate Charlie listening session.
Yes.
Alas.
Getting into this album feels like an almost impossible task because it contains so many multitudes, right? Just to name a few, at the surface, there is a personal narrative about marital infidelity and rediscovering love.
Check. You can taste the dishonesty, it's all over your breath, as you pass it off so cavalier, but even that's a test,
constantly aware of it all. There is incredible commentary on the multi-generational trauma of American race relationships in the modern black experience.
Check. Yeah. Open correctional gates in high desert. Yeah. Open our minds as we cast away oppression. Yeah. Open the streets and watch our beliefs. And when they carve my name inside the concrete, I pray it forever. Freedom, freedom.
It has a strong feminist narrative about self-determination and communal healing.
Check.
Right, this is some deep stuff. And on top of its many narratives, it's also a work of multitudes. It's in many mediums, right? It's cinema, it's poetry, it's dance, and of course, it's also music.
I completely agree with everything you said, except I have to point out that the plural of medium is in fact media. I'm such a jerk. I'm so sorry, Charlie.
I appreciate that.
But to your larger point, yes, 100%, this album is like galaxies wrapped in universes of sound. It's huge.
There's so much there. And part of it is that there is a multitude of producers, collaborators, co-writers, unbelievable amounts of samples. And musically, it moves across R&B, hip-hop, rock,
and even goes into the world of country.
Country!
Yeah.
Who would have guessed?
Well, that there is so much here, and that we cannot bore people with a multiple hour long episode of Switched on Pop. I think what we should do is instead look at just one song and see how it represents this body of work which contains multitudes. And it is so hard to pick just one song, but I think the best candidate for us today is going to be Hold Up.
Strong choice, Charlie.
They don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you. Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Oh love, they don't love you like I love you. Oh down, they don't love you like I love you.
So, Charlie, why Hold Up? Why is this a paradigmatic track from this record for you?
I'm not sure I understood what you just said, but I'm going to infer. Hold Up is the second track on the album, and I think that it's an essential piece because it introduces some of the main themes. We talked about the sort of surface narrative of the album about infidelity, and you know, Beyonce sings Hold Up, they don't love you like I love you. Like, yo, dude, what's going on? Why are you cheating on me? Those other ladies, they don't love you.
Yeah.
I love you.
It's a heartbreaking hook.
It's a heartbreaking hook. Part of the reason why I want to talk about this song, though, isn't because of its surface narrative about relationship, but instead, I want to go into how there is more than a single narrative here, that in fact, we're getting multiple points of view aided by a long list of contributors and some really unique sonic musical elements.
So I totally agree, but if this song can't have a single narrative necessarily, like what are the themes? What holds this song together? How does it cohere?
The main theme that I'm hearing here is composed frustration and also emotional restraint.
Mm.
I guess that's kind of two sides of the same coin.
I like that though.
And it's coming across both musically and narratively. What we're getting is this song where we expect an outburst of anger, right? It's about cheating.
Right.
And in the music video, Beyonce's walking down the street, smashing in car windows.
Indeed.
But what we're actually getting is this very interior song, a song about self-examination, about looking at multiple points of view, about feeling jealous and crazy at the same time.
Mm.
So what I want to do here is see how she builds up this unique point of view with the music and with the assistance of a bunch of collaborators.
Excellent.
They don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you.
So my first question for you is, what kind of song is this? Like, what traditions is it pulling from? What are you hearing?
Man, yeah. I mean, from the start, I hear something sort of distant and far away and like maybe even a little cheesy.
Ooh, okay.
Kind of this like like kind of cheap tropical synthesized sound heard from a distance, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. One of the producers on the song is Diplo, and he's known for borrowing heavily from calypso and dance hall style beats.
Indeed.
Right, so that's the first obvious thing that we're hearing. We're also very quickly hearing a cover, right?
Yeah, I feel like this is actually a song we've talked about on this podcast before.
We did. We spoke about Maps by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs on our Max Martin episode because he borrowed that track to create a Kelly Clarkson song.
Since You've Been Gone.
Since You've Been Gone.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whoa, man, this Yeah Yeah Yeahs song is like the gift that keeps on giving for pop producers.
It does. If we go back and listen to Maps, it's also a breakup song.
Oh, yeah, so it is.
But Maps takes the breakup song in a really different direction. It sets up the expectation of some sort of giant moment of emotional release.
Right.
there's this big break in the middle of the song where guitars wail and, you know, this heightened moment of energy.
Yes.
Okay, so I asked you, what is this song? And we hear a dance hall style thing. We hear a major rock song. But something feels really wrong to me if those are the two major references.
Right. The drums and guitars and the wall of sound never actually unleashes. It all remains very tight and tense.
Yeah, basically like the beat never drops.
No.
Yeah, there's like this one 4-bar section.
I always keep the top tier, 5-star, sexy loving in the car, like, make that wood, highly like a boulevard.
We're getting this build up and we think, oh, it's the whole thing's gonna drop right here, and it never does.
No, it is such a fake out.
So just as Beyonce is building up the expectation that she is lyrically going to let loose, she says that she'd rather be crazy and the whole thing's gonna blow up, musically we're getting the same thing. I think that Diplo and the IIS cover is setting up the expectation that this is gonna be a really big, explosive song. Instead, just as Beyonce is about to go crazy when she says, hold up. She's sort of saying, oh, wait, back up.
They don't love you like I
slow down. Let's reconsider.
Oh, yeah, and then the music itself kind of tightens up.
It all pulls back. Exactly.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm with you.
And I think musically, we are getting this influence from two of her other collaborators on the piece.
And which of the 300 collaborators would those be?
There's a lot. So I think we're getting a little bit from Father John Misty, who is a folk songwriter. And I especially think we're hearing a lot of influence from Ezra Koenig, who is the main songwriter from Vampire Weekend.
Yeah. And at this point, it's probably worth pausing for a moment to just say again, Father John Misty and Vampire Weekend are on this Beyonce record. What?
Multitudes, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So Ezra Koenig, back in 2011, actually came up with the idea for this song. It actually came out in a tweet.
Huh.
He was like, what if we, you know, reconfigured the MAPS Yeah 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 song?
Instead of saying, wait, they don't love you like I love you, hold up, they don't love you like I love you.
Exactly. And he had worked on a demo for the piece, and it probably should have ended up on the 2013 album Modern Vampires of the City, which was extraordinary because it has a lot in common with that album, especially the opening track, Obvious Bicycle. I want to take a listen to that really quickly.
Yeah, spin that.
Mornings come, you watch the red sunrise. The LED still flickers in your eyes. All you ought to spare, face the razor, because no one's gonna spare time for you.
So Obvious Bicycle is basically a track about the morning after a giant rave.
Huh.
And this song has that sort of same musical restraint that we're hearing in Beyonce. It has almost this quality of, like, you've stood in front of the speakers at a rave for way too long, and the next morning all you can hear is, like,
oh, Charlie, that was good.
There are all these elements of sort of hints of dance music. You can hear this like buzziness in the background, but it's almost like a memory of the night before.
So listen up. So listen.
And Beyonce, we're hearing a lot of the same sort of thing. There are all of these allusions to dance music. We hear this crazy siren. We hear sort of these drum buildups.
Right.
We even hear these like calling voices in the background of the track.
They don't love you like I love you. Back up,
but it never comes into the foreground. It almost feels like it's interior. It's inside of her head.
Whoa, it's the rave inside. The internal rave.
The rave or the rage inside.
Yeah. Ooh.
So we have all of these collaborators bringing these different points of view into this piece, which wants to let loose and yet is always holding back. And I want to look at specifically musically what's going on here to reinforce that same feeling.
what you called earlier, I love this phrase, composed frustration.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it begins with just the very first thing that we hear, these plucking pizzicato strings.
Yeah, there's two ways to play a stringed instrument, right? At least two, I should say. One is to bow the strings. That's probably the majority. That is called arco. But the other is to actually pluck the strings with your fingers. And that is called pizzicato, which in addition to being a really fun word to say, is, like you said, a very distinct musical texture that's much more controlled and quiet and intense than the alternative.
Yeah, they have a sense of actually being restrained. Rather than being let loose and singing wildly with a bow, they have a more muted quality to them.
Yeah, indeed.
I think it's mirrored most clearly in Beyoncé's vocal. I think it's in the second verse.
Let's imagine for a moment that you never made a name for yourself, a master wealth. They had you labeled as a king. Never made it out the cage, still out there moving in them streets. Never had the baddest woman in the game up in your shades.
When you listen to it, it's really clear that she's close mic'd. She's speaking super quietly. It almost sounds like she's just woken up from a nap. You can hear all of the rasp in her voice.
Oh, yeah. You can. I love this part. You can hear, like, every grain and every, like, fiber of her vocal cords. Totally.
So we have this inquisitive line in the background. We have this interior vocal. And I want to go into how are they interacting. So if we look at the chords that the pizzicato strings are playing, they sort of go up this line. And then they descend right back down the exact same progression. And so we're going up, and then we're going back down. We're going back up, and then down. Just as in the song, we're raising the expectations. Hey, you're cheating on me. What's up? Hold up. What's going on? And then sort of going back down to the progression.
Yeah. In classical, we would call that antecedent and consequent.
You've always got so many good things for us.
You're welcome.
If that's what's going on with instrumentally, if you look at Beyoncé's melody, I think we're getting the same quality. When she starts to sing the chorus, it starts on this high note, right?
Yeah.
She starts way up high, descends down a little bit. Sort of building up this expectation. And then right in the middle of her phrase, she makes this crazy leap in her vocal. We know that as the tritone.
Ah, the infamous tritone.
The devil in musica.
Yeah, diabolus in musica.
That's it. I don't remember my music theory as well as you do.
Well, I get paid too, so don't worry. It's not a lot.
So what does this all mean? Why is this important? So what I'm hearing is that, like, that tension of the angst of marital strife that she's experiencing starts in this high melody. You experience her internal frustration with this bizarre interval where right in the middle of her melody, she gives us the most dissonant musical interval. You can hear that craze that she speaks about. And then rather than bursting up into a higher octave, lets loose and walks all the way back down the scale.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, I totally hear that in that melody. It's like a crooked path. It's like trying to find itself as it slowly descends to the tonic.
Just as the chords kind of sound like they're trying to find themselves.
Yeah, yeah, okay, I'm with you.
Going up and down, the sedent thing. What was the sedent thing?
The antecedent and consequent.
That's the one.
Also the lamest rap duo ever. So the song, like, I totally agree. The song constantly seems to be building up tension, and then rather than exercising it with some cathartic release, kind of says, nope, hold up, zoop, bring it back in, everything's going to be okay. And
yeah,
this is a really interesting exercise, and it does leave you as a listener, I wonder, feeling a little like, okay, but I need that release. And I mean, what is, are they making a mistake not ever giving it on this song?
Absolutely not. Because as I was saying in the beginning, this album is a work of multitudes. There are so many themes and there is so much happening musically. And rather than giving us a resolution in this track, Beyoncé keeps us waiting for the next track.
Oh, so you're seeing the whole album as almost what in the romantic era they would call a song cycle, where each song is its own musical universe, but then the way they relate to the other songs actually tells a bigger story.
Absolutely. Here she's leaving us hanging and keeping us on the line so that we listen to the next piece, Don't Hurt Yourself, the major Jack White produced riff rock anthem with Led Zeppelin samples where she totally lets loose.
Whoa, Charlie, I need that. I need that release. Give me a little taste.
That's all you get.
Oh.
Because if,
that's so fresh.
It's so good. If you want to listen to the whole thing, you're going to have to listen more deeply to this entire work because, as I was saying, this album has so much on it. There's so much to experience. So I just implore everybody to go listen to Lemonade all the way through multiple times.
But don't go check it out just yet, because when we come back after a short break, we will be celebrating the music of Prince and examining the way he fused R&B, funk, and rock to create one of the century's most unique artistic statements.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you're anything like us, you're obsessed with music. Not just listening to it, but everything behind the scenes as well. What makes a good band? What makes a great song? And what does it take to make it big? All of these questions and more are explored in the remarkable new Broadway play, Stereophonic. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler, the story follows an up-and-coming 1970s rock band as they gather in a California music studio to record a brand new album, but it's a bumpy ride that threatens to tear the band apart. You may find yourself being reminded of the famous recording processes for legendary bands like Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and Fleetwood Mac. So get your tickets now and see Stereophonic live on Broadway this spring. Visit stereophonicplay.com/vox for more info. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
In order to dig deeper into the musical world of Prince, I have connected with Matthew Volness, a scholar and writer whose piece on Prince that recently appeared in the Musicology blog is one of the best things I've read about the late musician recently. Matthew is on the line. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I appreciate you joining us on this voyage. And as a fellow musicology PhD holder, I think we have a special connection to Prince.
Ooh, musicology. All right. Hold it down, band.
Right. Yeah, he did. He wrote a song just for that stressed our discipline, which is always nice to come across in popular music.
Exactly. Though I do wish my PhD was in advanced body movement.
Well, don't we all? I assume that only Prince is the one who can have one of those.
'Cause we got a PhD in advanced body movement.
That's right. So, Matthew, in your piece, you talk about growing up in Fargo, North Dakota, and listening to the Prince song, How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore. And I was wondering if you could just talk about your reaction to hearing that song for the first time.
Sure. Yeah. I actually came to Prince's music sort of embarrassingly late, given the fact that I grew up across the river from his home state.
Right.
I was listening to this album by this jazz saxophonist, Joshua Redman. I believe it was Timeless Tales for Changing Times. And the last track on that record is a cover of How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore, and I loved it. You know, I love Brad Mehldau's solo, loved Joshua Redman's solo on it. So I thought, all right, I gotta track the original down and see what's going on. You know, and found out it was a Prince tune. Popped it in. Had heard those first two chords, those first two piano chords, you know, that D flat going down to that E flat half diminished with the A and the bass. And, you know, I write in the blog, like, I was hooked. That was sort of an unbelievable musical moment for me.
What do you think it was about those two chords that sparked something in the young Matthew Volness growing up in Fargo, North Dakota?
Well, I think, you know, just sort of the musicianship that he displays, you know, he's not just playing block chords on the piano. It's this, you know, really sort of pianistic sort of transition between these two chords. And in addition, you know, when you get that, for me, really, it was that A natural in the bass. You know, it's not a chord that you find in a D flat major, or it's not a note that you find in a D flat major chord.
I always thought I loved so right, I guess I was wrong.
So the sort of mode mixture, you know, the sort of introducing unexpected notes really sort of piqued my interest and caught my ear. And so I, you know, heard that chord and just needed to hear more of Prince and his work after that.
Well, I love that you came to Prince via jazz.
Right.
Because as we'll talk about later, there is Prince, maybe more than most pop artists, seems to have a lot of sort of crossover appeal with the jazz world. And maybe it also comes back to one of the most compelling points for me in your piece, where you talk about that in the aftermath of Prince's death, many commentators have been saying that he is known for breaking down musical barriers. And in your piece, you're kind of like, yeah, maybe. But you could also say that what he was doing was actually kind of exposing the fact that sonic experimentation has a long history in black music and doesn't always fit so neatly into generic boundaries.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That, you know, Prince is just steeped in black music history. He was this incredible musician, this incredible improviser, incorporating all these different sounds and combining them with funk grooves. He was really engaging with, you know, sort of new sound technologies that that were around him at the time and that were being developed, and really just sort of honing it into this idea of, as you say, experimentation and improvisation and sonic architecture.
Beautiful. Okay, so improvisation, experimentation. I don't know if we could find all these things in a single song, but a good place to start could be what might be Prince's most popular song, When Doves Cry, off the 1984 album Purple Rain, and which I just checked is actually currently number 20 on the pop charts at the moment.
Beautiful.
And I think if we listen to this, we will see some of those attributes that you just described, starting maybe from the very beginning of this song,
right,
which starts with this just ripping guitar solo.
I mean, what can you say about that moment? I mean, it's, you know, sort of a perfect example of Prince's guitar chops. What I find really interesting about that moment in particular is, you know, so like he's clearly this amazing guitar player.
Right.
And then the guitar sort of disappears for a while and the song becomes this really sparse, almost austere funk track. You know, it's basically just Prince and his vocals, his multi-track vocals, this two-measure drum groove. With some synthesizer parts dropped in here and there. So it really sort of sets you up for this, you know, sort of explosive rock piece. And then you get this like really bare bones funk tune. And I think it's a really nice moment.
Yeah, that's true. Explosive guitar that immediately vanishes. And for a long time in this song, we're just left with, as you say, Prince's vocals and this drum loop.
Right.
There, at this moment, as you said, it's very sparse. And then something you point out in the article that is actually, to be honest, not a feature of the song that I ever recognized until you mentioned it, is I feel like we're kind of waiting for a certain instrument to arrive.
Right.
A certain guest to come to this musical party.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the tune, there's no bass line. I mean, here you have this funk tune that, like, doesn't have the instrument that came to symbolize the genre in the 1970s. You know, we have to keep in mind that, you know, we're not so far removed from the 70s in 1984, and we've got the Sly and the Family Stone track, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again, which introduced this, or if not introduced but popularized, this whole new way of playing bass, and it became like the focal point of that tune. So we've got that introducing the 1970s.
Right.
We take a trip 7 years later, and Bernie Worrell and P-Funk, you know, take the Mini Moog and they put it in outer space, and they give us, you know, he gives us this synthesized bass line that, you know, just comes to sort of encapsulate that tune. And then another seven years later, we all of a sudden have this cool funk tune that has no bass.
Right. So all of a sudden, one of the defining attributes of this musical style is just gone.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for it. I was like, no, there's got to be bass. Maybe if I get 3 minutes in, no bass. 4 minutes in, no. And then I'm, oh, the song is over. There was no bass in that track. It's unprecedented. I actually just made me realize, too, that Larry Graham, the bass player for Sly and the Family Stone, responsible for that famous bass riff that you just mentioned, I think was actually very good friends with Prince.
They were. That's true.
If I'm not mistaken, actually converted Prince to be a Jehovah's Witness after years of conversation.
Yes, that is correct. In 2001, he made the conversion.
In 2001. Okay, so you can corroborate that. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So no bass in this track, and so historically, in this 1984 moment, you point out that's very bizarre. And then why do you think Prince chose that for this track specifically?
You know, it's always sort of difficult to speculate what Prince was thinking. He was, you know, so far ahead of all of us. But, you know, so there's this great dissertation that came out of UCLA in 2008. It's written by this musicologist, Griffin Woodworth, who does a really great analysis of this tune. Musicology. And so he points out that there was a bass line, that Prince had a bass line for it originally and then stripped it away. And so he's making the claim that that sort of the removal of the bass line really sort of highlights the two-measure drum groove and really allows the listener to sort of focus on the multiple layers that are going on in that drum section.
Okay. So this drum groove kind of takes the place of the bass line, perhaps. It does kind of become very melodic after you listen to it for a long time.
Right. I mean, for a while, it's the most prominent feature in the track. An ocean of violets in bloom. Animals strike curious.
Listening to it, I wonder, I'm tempted to argue that Prince finds ways to substitute for that low-end range that is missing.
Mm.
One of those places I feel like is in the vocal itself, which is very, very low.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's got those, he splits his voice into octaves during parts of the track. And you're absolutely right. He's got that low growling part of his vocal line. I would add, you know, absolutely agree with that, that it's sort of filling in those moments. But I guess what I'd like to, you know, sort of counter that with is that, you know, bass lines have become very melodic and very sort of prominent. And those moments with the vocal line, while you're absolutely right, they're there. They don't ever sort of supersede, you know, this drum groove that's going on.
I accept your counterpoint. Okay, so something you just said that I also want to highlight in this song is this what you described as the multi-octave vocal range of Prince. We should mention that this is one of the many songs on which Prince plays every instrument.
Right.
And every vocal, I think. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
So then when we're listening to the chorus of this song and we hear harmonies stretching from the very low to the very high, those are all Prince.
That's correct. That's all Prince.
So that means that, I mean, I was at the piano earlier. I think he sings from an A 2 octaves below middle C to an A 2 octaves above middle C. Could that be possible?
It's certainly possible. I will trust your transcription skills. But yeah, I mean, his vocal range is sort of ridiculous.
A 4-octave vocal range. I mean, that is staggering. I think we think of him as having a very distinctive falsetto.
Yes.
On, you know, maybe like famous songs like Kiss and so forth, but on Dove's Cry, we hear the full spectrum of his voice. It's like, it's kind of astonishing.
Yeah, and you know, he uses his voice to really sort of fill out those textures that are missing from, you know, the instrumentation that you would expect in you know, like a very funk-oriented tune, like the basses we've talked about, and you know, like a horn section. He doesn't have a horn section. You know, he's got the synthesizer line sort of filling those in, but yeah, really using that multi-tracked voice to fill out the textures at sort of key structural moments in the piece.
Good. So I think we're getting back to this idea of experimentation. He's working within many of the boundaries of funk style, but in other ways pushing against them and maybe opening whole new doors within this style.
Yeah, absolutely.
This brings me to another kind of endlessly entertaining clip that you have unearthed from the internet. This is not Prince's famous Super Bowl performance. This is
the press conference before the Super Bowl. It's a great moment. Like, you know, everyone talks about how great the Super Bowl performance is, and no doubt it was a phenomenal performance. But, you know, for my money, like, I just think that press conference is fantastic.
I totally agree. So, yeah. OK, so this is maybe where they're announcing that Prince is going to play, and he plays a few songs. And he does this thing that you point out that I just watched on repeat about 20 times. Can you describe how this performance starts?
Sure. So, you know, Prince and the band walk out and he steps up to the microphone. I'm not sure if I'm going to get the quote exactly right. He says something along the lines of, contrary to rumor, you know, I'd like to take some questions now. And he looks around and there's, you know, there's some reticence. And then some reporter stands up and starts to pose the question saying, Prince, how do you feel about it? And then he just comes in with the first chord on Johnny B. Goode with that, you know, that little smirk that he has after the band comes in.
Thank you, John, for those kind words. We hope we don't wreck your ears too much. Contrary to rumor, I'd like to take a few questions right now.
Prince, how do you feel about
it is, I mean, it is completely jaw-dropping to me. And then, yeah, just the playfulness and the kind of, I don't know, it's a great moment. But then, you're right, he plays a song you might not expect Prince to play, Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry.
Right, yeah. You know, Prince was didn't cover any tunes until, it might be like the Emancipation record in like 96 or 97. Like he was, you know, had written so much original material. And so when you get a chance to hear Prince play, you know, when you get a chance to hear him cover a tune, it's quite the event, I think.
I agree. And I think this tune in particular resonated with the other things you were talking about in your article, because it's a song that is in many ways regarded as the one of the real benchmarks of rock and roll music. And maybe I feel like almost Prince is maybe reminding the audience that rock and roll is in fact black music, is a testament to the diversity of black musical practice that you talk about.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, and he was, he did that again in his most, you know, the last sort of studio record that he released, the Hit and Run Phase 2. There's a track called Black Muse where he talks about, you know, all of the sort of musical practices and the musical genres that form the core of black music history, where he talks about jazz, he talks about rhythm and blues, talks about rock and roll and soul. So I think you're absolutely right that he's, you know, placing, rock and roll firmly within the trajectory of black music history.
Right. And then I wonder, this might be too much, but I wonder if even if we accept that, maybe he is even reinforcing it later in that performance when he starts to do these Jimi Hendrix style kind of wah-wah riffs, and he's saying, yeah, Hendrix was rock too, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think that's spot on.
There's one other beautiful clip that you discuss in your piece that maybe brings this all home, which is of the great jazz bassist Marcus Miller performing live this long composition in the middle of an extended bass solo. Completely unexpectedly, he starts to play When Doves Cry.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite the moment. It's from a live clip from, I believe, the 2011 North Sea Jazz Festival. And I was fortunate enough to actually be at that performance. And so, you know, just to sort of, it took a while for me to really wrap my head around that. You know, here's this jazz bassist, this like incredibly accomplished jazz bassist, you know, soloing beautifully on this tune, Jean-Pierre, and then all of a sudden he quotes perhaps the most famous and popular tune that doesn't have a bass
right.
in his bass solo. It's like mind-blowing that all these things are happening at the same time.
And this very mechanical, like highly synthesized song works surprisingly well as a jazz tune, I find.
I completely agree with that assessment. You know, the audience members, if you can hear it in the clip, you know, go nuts when they recognize what he's playing.
So, Matthew, from Fargo, North Dakota in the 80s to Rotterdam in the 2000s, Prince seems to have been a real core part of your musical identity, even in ways that you might not expect. And I really appreciate you talking about that legacy with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for the invitation.
This episode of Switched on Pop was produced by me, Charlie Harding.
And moi, Nate Sloan.
And our logo was designed by Luke Harris.
We were joined today by Matthew Volness, a scholar and writer based out of Durham, North Carolina. We'll link to some more of his work on our website.
And if you like our show and are really interested in the history of music, we suggest you check out Behind the Liner Notes. We were recently featured on their episode about the singing male castrati, pulling from one of our episodes on One Direction. And so you definitely ought to go check it out at behindthelinernotes.com or wherever you find your podcasts.
Speaking of which, you can find more episodes of our show on our website, www.switchedonpop.com.
You can also speak to us on Twitter at @SwitchedOnPop. And if you're a longtime listener and you haven't reviewed the show on iTunes yet, we'd really appreciate it if you left us a note there so we know what you like and what you want more of.
Yeah. Or if you're short on time, just hit 5 stars and leave a smiley face.
We'd really appreciate it.
We'll be back again in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, thanks for listening. This episode of Switched on Pop is brought to you by Wix.com. Wix.com has hundreds of designer-made templates to help you build a professional site for your business. Go to Wix.com to get started today. The result is stunning.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of the Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.